Where's Peter?
Put the Old Testament over there. Old Testament over there! More garlic on the side, too. Catch.
Peter!
Stop him!
It's me, Charlie!
Back the fuck up, I will fucking use this motherfucker!
What the hell, Peter?
Are you one of them or not?
Them?
A vampire!
Of course I'm not a vampire! Satisfied?
Let him in.
What is that?
It's a stake affix. The weapon that is said to have killed Vlad the Impaler, a.k.a. motherfucking Dracula.
And you got it how?
Stole it from the props department.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I am your host, Jason Bishop, and with me today, as always, is Sam Stepanenko.
It's daylight out.
That was the most unconvincing vampire scream.
It was on purpose.
Well, yes, I see where the purpose comes in. And Trish Coughlin.
Features of the night.
Trish Coughlin, our resident succubus?
I don't know. I don't think I take a men's energy sexually. I think I just take it by wearing them down.
By attrition, no less?
That's awesome. A war of attrition. And I break down their walls with humor, and then they just fall to my wiles, my whims.
Well, that works too. And Jeff Omega, he's away this week. He's gone on a little treasure hunt. No, literally, that's what he told us he was doing.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's see if he comes back with anything. I told him to do a little travel log for us. I don't know if he will or not, but
I hope so.
Millennials, you never know if they're going to do what they're told or not.
What if he finds like something that will help defeat vampires? What if he finds some wonderful esoteric artifact?
That would be very cool. Like, do you think there's a lot of those lying around in Montreal?
You never know.
You never know. I don't know what the vampire situation's like in Montreal.
Well, it is a very Catholic city, or was, so You never know.
Yeah. Well, before we get started and talking about more about vampires, we got to talk about the fish in the room. We started something last week. We started something with Trish's angry fish, and that led Sam down this fun little rabbit hole. Now we've learned a whole lot about Angry Fish in his past, and he was a really tremendous movie star.
Tremendous
really
movie star.
Was.
Yes, he was in some amazing stuff like, he had his slumps as well with movies like Chum.
Yeah.
But A Fish Full of Dollars is a classic. Fish of Fury, classic.
Yep. I think that it really helped me understand where he was coming from when we first met. And I think it was that whole, like, don't you know who I am?
Yeah.
And I didn't. I feel bad about that.
And you met him like post Death Fish.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think he was in kind of semi-retirement at that time.
Right. Crazy stuff. But we actually were able to dig into some of the archives in the vaults and find some of his classic movie posters. And now it's merchandise over at our TeePublic store.
Yes.
Right? And
yes.
It's amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. Sam kind of helped us tweak it and get it up there. But restore it to its original glory, as it were. But Angry Fish, wow. Who knew that there was such a vast history to Angry Fish?
Absolutely. And I came there to look at sharks. I had no idea such a huge star was just sitting there in front of me.
Yes, yes. The most dangerous thing in the sea was that little fish.
It really was.
He assaulted you, for crying out loud.
He did. He bit me a lot.
More injured than any shark.
Yeah. I've been more injured by a fish than any shark or any other animal in the ocean, really.
He would be one of those temperamental movie stars, right? And he just thought you were paparazzi.
Yes.
True. I did have a camera.
Well, then you caught him in his angriest.
Yeah, yeah, I did.
You caught him in his Sean Penn moment.
It really was a Sean Penn moment.
Yeah, yeah. Fish pen. Salmon pen.
Yeah. So get your Angry Fish merchandise over at tpublic.com.
Or just go to our site and click on store. It'll take you there.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Just go to our website, our Wix site, and you can find it there. Sam, what's the address to the Wix site?
invasionoftheremake.wixsite.com/podcast.
There you go. And you can listen to last week's episode and find out more about Angry Fish over there as well. Okay, this week we're going to be talking about Fright Night Part 2 from 1988. This is a sequel to the original Fright Night, which we talked about in episode 45, and I highly recommend you go back to listen to episode 45, as this is a sequel to an episode we talked about. Crazy.
Our first time ever.
First time ever, over 200-some-odd episodes, 250-some-odd episodes, and we've never done a sequel. And now this is not just a sequel to a movie we've talked about, but a sequel to an episode we've done as well. So we're going to be talking about Fright Night Part 2 from 1988 and Fright Night 2 New Blood from 2013. Now, this is not just unique in the fact that we're talking about sequels. The 2013 film, they call it a sequel to the 2011 film with Anton Yelchin, but it really isn't. It is just a third remake of the original film. And the original Fright Night Part 2, like, this isn't a remake of that, because they couldn't get the rights to that movie. Not that they don't take inspiration from it by switching their main vampire to a female and a seductress at that, but they have traveled their own path as well. So why didn't we just compare it back to the original film? Well, we've done that. So this gives us an opportunity to talk about Fright Night Part 2, as well as dive into this new remake of Part 1, and see what they've cribbed from both movies.
Because there is some from the original Fright Night 2, for sure. Not as much as I might have hoped, but there is some.
Mm-hmm.
This is a kind of a unique situation where we get to talk about just sequels in general, and why they do them. Both of them, clearly, because it's a successful film, wanting to make some money, and then seeing it fall apart for various reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for Fright Night Part 2, they wanted to get it a nice big theatrical release, as you do. The first one was quite successful, and I have no doubt the second one would have been successful as well, but it only got a limited release because the producers of the film that were going to distribute this film, which was a division of Coralco at the time, was Jose Menendez. And if that sounds familiar, yes, this is that Jose Menendez who was murdered by his two children, Lyle and Eric. And that's a very famous case. Just go look it up. It was the Menendez brothers. Was huge for, like, in the news for years. People studied that case. A&E specials and all sorts of stuff. So that really derailed the release of this film. And it only got a limited release. So financially, it was a complete failure, which killed any chance of a third film ever happening.
That the story yeah, kind of helped kill it a little bit. I mean, it's not bad, but
yeah, but there. Well, with the limited release it did have, what I read was it probably could have done okay with a wide release, but basically it was kind of riding on the coattails of, like, the first one. It would be one where people would go to see. It's like, oh, I love the first Fright Night. It probably wouldn't have gone well because it was really good. It would have done okay because people just really liked Fright Night.
Well, I think to a certain extent it was riding on the laurels of Lost Boys and stuff as well, because Lost Boys was 87, this is 88. I think they were trying to cash in on the resurgence of the vampire
film.
Oh, you can certainly see the influence of Lost Boys on this film.
Particularly the makeup, and I do have to say the makeup in the sequel is superior to the original. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd say so too. The effects makeup and just makeup in general. There's just a coolness of Lost Boys that they did wind up capturing somewhat within this film. I mean, it's not a better film than the original at all, but there is a slickness to it. Like, if they had a better story behind this, I mean, for the most part, they were just kind of regurgitating the same formula from the first one. And you could tell, like, some characters were meant to return, and like the Stephen Joffrey's character of Evil Ed, which has actually been reinstated in the Fright Night Part 2 remake. Yeah, with an Evil Ed. But Stephen Joffrey's did not want to return for this particular sequel because he was offered the lead in 976 Evil, and why wouldn't you turn down a lead? Do the lead rather than the supporting part, right? So they wound up having to rewrite the role, which got moved over to the character of Louis by John Grease. So you can see that the formula is still kind of here. You still have Dandridge here, but it's his sister looking for a little revenge. And she does move in next door, but it's not next door to Charlie. It's next door to Peter, even though Charlie's still the stalker of the group, which is funny because he's got a real problem. It's like a Rear Window situation, but he actually winds up being right.
You know what? It's like remember Bewitched, and there was like the nosy neighbor that would always look out. This is the movie based on the nosy neighbor.
Like, he's just lucky enough or unlucky enough to keep finding vampires, but he's got some serious stalker vibes. I can see why his girlfriend didn't come back.
Yeah, well, and to be fair, she was stalking him too. Right? Yeah. I mean, there's another element of Lost Boys that was actually stolen whole cloth for this movie because she's turning him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right, so he is.
Yeah, she's looking for a slow revenge. Like with Peter, she realizes, oh, here's this coward who kind of just got suckered into the situation of killing her brother. So she just ruins his career. And what I think is one of the better moments of the film, where she takes over his show as this hostess. And the actress wasn't interested in being like an Elvira clone. And the performance artist thing was really interesting. I really kind of dug that.
I have to say, I like that angle. But I think the one major problem I kind of had with this movie is that I didn't think she needed to be Dandridge's sister. I didn't think that was necessary. I think she just could have been another vampire, and it would have been much better.
This is like the Jaws 4 thing, and like, it's always a revenge plot. Like, you've been around for thousands of years, you know the risk. You're vampires, and there are vampire hunters out there. And if you're off killing human beings, one of them might actually get the better of you. It's just part of parcel of being a vampire, I would think. But she was playing games, and she was playing the long game with Charlie, trying to seduce him and slowly turn him into a vampire, with, I think, the hope of having him murder all of his friends.
There's something that in the two movies that's very different, where in the remake redo in 2013, the vampire doesn't show up on film. But in this one, like, having her be the host is a great idea. But I was always kind of wondering, like, going, would they show up on film? Was that...
Well, we've seen that in other vampire things where, I mean, if they're not casting a reflection, we've seen that with photography and stuff in other films. So it is a depending on your vampire lore situation. There's actually another piece of vampire lore that is rarely used in film, and something I really appreciated by the 88 film is when Alex shoves roses into a vampire's mouth, and that was, I do believe, in Bram Stoker's novel.
Yes, because she references it, because remember, she speed reads the movie.
Oh, the most ridiculous speed reading I've ever seen. Like, is that how it's done?
Yeah. I don't know. That's my question for you guys. I didn't know if that was how you did it.
I don't know. It looks weird, but I was like, does she have to be a speed reader? Like...
She did, in order for her to read all of Dracula in one night.
I suppose.
This is a really tight timeline, right?
Yeah, but did it have to be? I mean, if it's going to be a long game on Dandridge's part, it didn't have to be that way, but whatever. I guess it's fine. The speed reading was just, I guess, added a little bit to the silly. Like, I mean, it is a horror comedy, so it was kind of a chuckly moment, I guess, watching her do that.
And the other thing that they borrowed heavily from Dracula, too, is the Renfield, right?
Yes. Brian Thompson's Bosworth character. And
different Renfield.
Yeah. He was very different. Like, I remember when I first saw this movie, and even now, because I'd forgotten a lot of it, thinking, he's the Renfield character, and he's the familiar, he's human, he can walk during the day, but No, I don't think he actually was human, per se, but he wasn't vampire either.
No, he was something unique to the movie, but it was definitely, especially with the bug eating and stuff like that, that was definitely a nod to Dracula's Renfield.
Yeah, and it was actually Brian Thompson's idea when he ate the bugs to name the genus and phylum of these insects, which I thought was wonderful.
Yeah.
It was kind of shade of his character in Kindred as well. That he would play another vampire later on.
Well, I like the idea, like, he's Renfield. I enjoyed it because, like, I mean, if you're going to keep a familiar around, they need to be pretty darn useful. And I think some of the portrayals of Renfield, he's just so pathetic. And that sort of doesn't make much sense. But when he's useful and very easy to utilize, I would see why a vampire would go with him.
Yeah, I mean, he actually had sway of the other of the brood. You can tell he's this big, beefy dude who's meant to protect, especially during the daytime, the right-hand man of Regine.
Yeah, the bodyguard element, I think, really works for Renfield, and I think it should be more often used.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I totally agree, and I love the relationship that her nest had, because you had the sort of the werewolfy type with John Grease, and then you had sort of the glammy type. Oh, I can't remember the character's name.
Bell,
yes. I should remember that was my dog's name. and then you have the Renfield characters, and I love when they go bowling.
Mm-hmm. That was pretty funny.
There was a feeling of camaraderie there, which I found really interesting. And again, maybe borrowed a little bit from, again, Lost Boys, especially with the look for Belle, right? That was very Lost Boys-ish with the punky glam kind of look, right?
Yeah, the little more androgynous look.
Yeah.
Maybe now's the time to actually look at the trailer. Now we're starting to dig into the characters, and we'll come back and talk more Fright Night Part 2 from 1988.
Tired of good girls?
Good night, Charlie.
Ready for some real excitement? Looking for someone incredibly seductive?
Do you know how to use your lips, Charlie?
Rescue me! Or take me in your arms!
Then this is your lucky night.
Welcome to Fright Night.
Fright Night 2.
I kill.
Enter a world where each embrace takes your breath away.
Come kiss me.
Maybe it's the full moon, Charlie.
And every kiss is a killer. Roddy McDowell. William Ragsdale.
Do you mind if I borrow these?
If you thought one was fun... Wait till you do two. Fright Night 2.
Oh, man.
All right. Fright Night Part 2 from 1988 was based on the characters created by Tom Holland, who has graced our show multiple times. And yeah, the first time was in episode 102.
Oh, that was Class of 84, but that wasn't the first time.
Wasn't the first time?
No,
Fright Night.
Episode 45. Well, I already mentioned 45, so I was kind of skipping over it. But yes, episode 45 would have been Fright Night, and episode 102, Class of 1984. And then again in episode 211, very recently.
Yes, Child's Play.
That's right.
I'd forgotten about that one. I'm like, oh, yeah, he did that.
He was most famous for it.
Yeah. It's weird. Tom Holland is very associated with big hair in my head right now.
You got big hair in your head?
Well, yeah, big hair in my head. On my head, around my head, in my head.
Just a mane. This was written by Tim Metcalf, most famous for being the creator and story writer for Revenge of the Nerds series of films, and Miguel Tejada Flores, also famous for the Revenge of the Nerds, but also a little film I really liked and I've talked about in 31 Days of Horror. Yes, that's coming up soon. Frankenstein's Army from 2013. Really awesome little film that everybody should check out. This was also written and directed by Tommy Lee Wallace, who directed the It miniseries from 1990. He also was art director and sound editor on episode 120, Assault on Precinct 13, and he was an actor in episode 59 when we talked about Halloween.
Hmm.
So, well-rounded dude. The stars,
yeah, some good stuff.
That's right. The stars, the returning William Ragsdale as Charlie Brewster, and of course, from episode 45, Fright Night, as well as Roddy McDowall from the same movie. That was the first time we got to talk about him among many times we talked about him. He plays Peter Vincent in this movie, very famous for playing that role, and he loved playing that role. But then again, we talked about him in episode 102, which was class of 1984. Then again, in episode 151.
Well, that was Planet of the Apes. No, that was Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
And then, oh, yeah, yeah.
And then episode 216.
Planet of the Apes?
Nope.
Nope, the black hole.
She's just going to keep getting
I'm never going to win this. She's just going to keep guessing. We're going to get there.
And then episode 236.
Planet of the Apes?
Yes.
Yay. And don't forget episode 69, Jay.
Apparently.
You can't forget 69.
I can. And
he was in the Poseidon Adventure as well.
Oh. Yes!
I knew I was going to miss one.
There's so many.
I ran out of room.
I just realized.
I couldn't fit in another one.
Just realized the Poseidon Adventure was episode 69, but it's about a boat being flipped upside down.
Ooh.
We didn't plan that, but we could have. Yeah.
We'll say we did, though, if you find it funnier that way.
Realizations, guys. Realizations.
Tracy Lind was Alex, and she was in the kind of pseudo-sequel to Class of 84, Class of 1999. Julie Carmen was Regine Dandridge. She was also in another John Carpenter horror movie, In the Mouth of Madness.
Love that one.
Yeah, it's so cool. John Grease was Louis, as I mentioned, and we've talked about him many times. Not as many as Roddy McDowall, but he's starting to rank them up there a little bit. Episode 149.
Running Scared.
Episode 180.
Real Genius.
And episode 208.
Where he played another hairy monster in Monster Squad.
Yes, yeah. Monster Squad.
I wonder if they just used his same werewolf outfit.
It looks similar, if I'm honest.
Yeah. Russell Clark was Bell, and he's more famous as a choreographer, and that's what he came on this film to do. He was the roller skating androgynous vampire who doesn't talk in this movie, and because of that, the coolest one. But he came in, he also did choreography on this film for the dance sequences. He did stuff like Body Rock and Xanadu, so as a choreographer. So he's done a lot of choreography in film, usually for the musicals. Brian Thompson is... He's actually probably the biggest that guy you saw in that thing that one time.
Mm-hmm.
He's in a ton of stuff, ton of TV for sure. Probably the first time anybody really noticed him was in the Terminator movie, where it was a small scene, but it was a pivotal one because that's when the Terminator comes back in time and kills this dude for his clothes. That was Brian Thompson. And he would play another vampire in Kindred the Embraced, a short-lived TV series based on the White Wolf Vampire Masquerade roleplay game, which was actually not bad.
And he was also in Buffy, and I can't remember if he played a vampire in that.
Yeah, he was in Buffy as well. I'm trying to remember if he was a vampire. He must have been. Who wasn't?
Well, exactly. And I think he was in there as multiple characters through different times, because I know he played...
He's done lots of makeup roles as well. So he's been on Orville recently and Star Trek and stuff. So he's played a lot of aliens and monsters as well, because he's got a unique jaw.
And cheekbones, too. His face is very, very structured. Like, it's very... Almost stone-like.
Yes.
Well, I remember him from the Stallone movie Cobra, because his face was so distinct for that.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I remember him, because like that jawline is just fascinating. Like, he's got an incredible look.
Merritt Buttrick played Richie in this movie, and he's most famous for playing Captain Kirk's son David in Star Trek 2 and 3. And this would be one of his final roles, too, because he had been diagnosed with AIDS actually during the shooting of this film, and they were well aware and took a lot of precautions that they didn't puncture his skin during the vampire scenes, just out of protection, because in 88 they didn't know what AIDS, how it's transmitted like they do now, and it was basically a death sentence in 88. So this was a very touchy subject, but at the same time, they were good on them for still casting him in the parts, even though they knew that he had this disease that was still relatively unknown to people.
And his decline was really rapid too, because he passed in 1989, and this was probably filmed in 87 or early 1988 before its release. So yeah, it was really fast decline. Even then, that would have been a fast decline.
Yeah. Ernie Sabella was Dr. Harrison. He's probably most famous for playing Pumbaa in The Lion King, everything, all the spinoffs and whatnot. But he was Pumbaa. But we've actually talked about him back in episode 207.
Oh, I didn't get that one.
Oh, that was The Out of Towners.
Oh, that's why I didn't get it.
You hate that movie.
I really dislike both of them. I liked the remake better, but that was listen to the episode.
Yeah. Matt Landers plays Mel, and Matt was in some action gems here. He's probably got a nice long resume of these, but things like 48 Hours, Die Hard, and Commando. So he got around on all these action movies. Josh Richman was Fritzy, and he was in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, longtime friend of Robert Downey Jr. Karen Anders was Mrs. Stern, who was in... I just wanted to write it down because I still don't know what this is about, but it's a great title. Bad Charleston Charlie from 1973.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Put on the list of our things, someday Patreon episodes. Yeah.
Yeah. Something we're going to just have to make up a plot for. Rochelle Ashana was an art major in this, but she was a stunt actress, and she was in movies like A Blade and Escape from L.A. as a stunt actress. And Blair Tefkin was Bernice, who was regular through most of the 80s iterations of the sci-fi television show V.
Nice.
Yeah. So a nice, well-rounded 80s cast. Now, opens with Charlie has been convinced by a psychiatrist that vampires don't exist, and this was mass hypnosis from the first film, kind of opening the door for them for history to repeat itself.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I've forgotten about that conceit, and I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot about this, and I actually found it a little bit annoying, the whole denial and then revisiting the fact that they're real thing.
Well, I don't know, it's sort of, yeah, denial and then revisiting they're real, but it sort of makes... It's a, in a weird way, it made sense to me, because after everything that happened at his neighbor's house, the cops are going to ask questions and stuff's just going to happen. So like, he's got 3 years of a whole bunch of shit ahead of him, and he is going to be thought insane. So, I mean, his turn is sort of what bothered me, and how he got so quickly back to they're real when he'd spent so much time in therapy trying to convince himself that they weren't.
Yeah, maybe it's just because it was so clumsily handled that I didn't enjoy it. I mean, conceptually, I guess it sounded, but it felt clumsy.
Honestly,
yeah, I'm with you on that.
I think they threw it in there so they could have the psychiatrist character be a mentor to his girlfriend and have that funny death scene for him when he's been turned. We don't actually know he's been turned until he does try to attack Alex, but I honestly think he was just there to set up a gag more than anything else. So consequently, yeah, they had to put him in more scenes just so they could get that scene out rather than transfer it to some other character.
Oh, well, and the one scene, like the gag where he's turned, that's fine. But the one scene that bothered me the most was he's telling me, he's like, I'm dreaming too much. And then he opens this drawer that's packed to the hilt of like loose prescriptions. And he takes out like a handful. Which he's just going to give to Charlie.
Yeah, I thought that was like horribly irresponsible of the dude.
Right?
It kind of establishes the character a little bit, I suppose. But yeah, they could have done it.
He's a bad shrink.
Well, yeah, we've established that because he tries to eat Alex.
And well, not see, I like when she stakes him and she kind of misses, and then he uses this of like, how does this make you feel? You should embrace that emotion. You know what? Don't feel bad about missing. I'll take care of this myself. I really quite enjoyed that. Kind of flat acting, but it was a pretty funny moment.
There's lots of great writing in this movie. Like it's not a bad sequel all in all. It's just parts of it are clumsy, and it does harm the film a little bit.
Now, I've heard that Tom Holland would like to do a Fright Night 3 with the remaining cast that's still with us at this point and bring them back, which I think we're going to probably see a trend of 80s things do this with the older actors now in their 50s and 60s returning to these parts in a very Cobra Kai-esque kind of way, now that that show's really popped on Netflix. It was just hiding out on YouTube and nobody watched it there, but now that it's on Netflix, it's becoming a bit of a phenomenon. And I can see this maybe resulting in things like Fright Night returning. And I think there's better opportunity here to do that, because it was a fun concept and there's fun things you can work with. I hope we can move away from the Jerry Dandridge situations and revenging vampires and whatnot. So I'm not sure where they can go, but at least there's humor in this. I can't say that about the 2013 film, where they say it's a horror comedy and the comedy bits are few and far between.
And they're not funny at all.
Not really.
I mean, Evil Ed is obviously supposed to be the comic relief.
He's just a little annoying.
He's terrible. Exactly. I couldn't wait for him to die. That was my entire feeling.
The worst part is, you could tell they rushed through it. Like, the script only took a week to write and another 2 months to polish, which probably should have been the other way around, because it's not a very good script. And the actors clearly didn't have enough time with it, especially with the prosthetics, when you have the actor who plays Evil Ed, and he couldn't act through his prosthetic teeth. It's just like, oh my God, he's spitting all over the place. It's terrible. I mean, the most talented people are Will Payne and Jamie Murray, but they didn't give Jamie's a very capable actress, but they didn't give her a lot of dialogue. They just let her look sultry a lot.
Yeah. And then when they did give her dialogue, it was frequently cliched.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it shouldn't have been, like, I don't know. I've seen her. There was another TV show she was in called Valentine, which I loved. I thought she was great in. But, like, she's a great seductive actress, but she does so much better when she's allowed to play with it. Like, I would have liked to see her more playing with her food.
Yeah, because
that's what I would like.
She's very femme fatale, and, you know, you can see that within shows like Dexter. And even Warehouse 13, really, her stint on that show. But yeah, she didn't get a chance to do that. And I think that plays back to the 88 film, where Julie Carmen is very much a seductress and a quiet one at that. Like, it's all through movement and mannerisms rather than dialogue. Not that she's not capable of it. She's very capable of it. But you don't really notice it. You think about it near the end. It's like, oh, she didn't really talk a whole lot, did she?
Mm-hmm.
You're right. It was very much about the look and her actions. Mm-hmm. And they could have done that in the 2013 remake quite easily. Instead of focusing, like, there's that one scene where she's harvesting the French girl.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And they're so focused on the French girl, when they could have been more focused on Murray's character, sort of showing the pleasure she's taking out of the action rather than the effects that they were using to try and draw you in and the focus on her naked body.
There's, like, interesting, cool stuff, like that opening of the 2011 at the gas station. It's really cool, but it doesn't match the rest of the film. From my understanding, they were thinking about closing the film that way and making it look like maybe that version of Jerry Dandridge, Jamie Murray's character, is still possibly alive. I'm glad they didn't do that, but it doesn't match the rest of the film with what they're trying to do. It was very much like the Nightmare on Elm Street, where you're seeing somebody being murdered through the security footage in the gas station, but you can't see the attacker because of you can't see the reflection of a vampire, and that includes being recorded.
And when I saw it, I thought I was watching the wrong movie, essentially. I was worried.
Initially, I did too.
And but you know what? You know, sometimes when you watch a movie and it's only till the end of a scene, you're like, oh, that was budget padding.
Yeah.
We paid for it. We filmed it. We need to pad the runtime. That's all it is.
Yeah, that's quite possibly what that is. I mean, I found that 2013 more often than not had some cool ideas, but they didn't know how to execute it with the rest of the script. I mean, I really thought the idea of Jerry Dandridge being Countess Bathory was fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, and I loved the animated sequence.
The motion comic.
That was so well done. And it was probably the best part of the movie.
Yeah, I thought that was really good. I mean, and that was just to trim down the budget so they didn't have to shoot it. In a historical sense, it was to keep the budget down, but it worked beautifully.
It did, because it felt like you're being told a story.
Yeah, I think it was probably the most solid sequence of the film. And that was all narrated by Chris Waller, who plays Evil Ed, who we've been kind of bashing on a little bit. But he narrated that whole thing and did a decent job at it. So you can
see
some of
his stuff. Some of his Yeah, some of his problems, I think, were direction. And if somebody else is directing the voiceover, he's doing better.
I mean, when you look at Stephen Joffrey's in the original film, I'm like, this evil head ain't any worse than Joffrey's was.
No, that's fair. Right. And I mean, yeah, and I think it was the writing that failed him rather than his performance. Like, I can't say his performance was bad. Mm-hmm. I just think it was as Trish said, there's the direction. And he wasn't given good dialogue because he was not funny. He was a misogynistic prick is what he was.
Yeah. Well, why are these people friends? I didn't get that at all. Like, why is Charlie spending 2 minutes with this dude?
Yeah, there's no real chemistry. Well, they got shoved together in a room in Romania together.
Well, no, but they knew each other before.
Yeah, the teacher says, like, oh, the gang's back together. Doesn't look like Charlie's all that thrilled about it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, they never really get into their history. And that's a thing. Like, this is supposed to be the sequel to the Anton Yelchin movie, but it's not a sequel at all. It's a standalone. It does its own little thing. And that's because nobody wanted to come back for this crap script. Anton was still with us at that point. So I think he'd be another 3 years before he passed away.
But yeah, there's no way they would have gotten him for this. No, but it's not based on that script. You're right.
Yeah, but the success of that film made them rush in to make another one, but they didn't have anything to make. They didn't even have the rights to the sequel. So all they could make was another remake.
Which it seems like, I don't know, sometimes there's a hodgepodge of stuff they threw in that I think they just like, oh, I want to put this in because it looks cool. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, we've all been to lectures. I don't recall a single one where there's a constant flashing of images on a screen.
She sure knows how to make an entrance to a lecture, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Cool to start with, but the fact they continued with is where it got annoying. I think they it was sort of established her as sort of this cool professor, but then moved to sort of more of a traditional lecture format instead of sitting through a lecture that was like, because it was actually starting to make me a little nauseous watching. And it's like, okay, enough with the flashing. And then the same when they're in the tunnels.
Yeah, when they're doing her bat thing. And I'm like, oh man, this would trigger an epileptic seizure.
Oh yeah, disclaimer for this episode. If you suffer from any seizures, do not watch that 2013 movie at all.
Do not. That's a health risk. There was no warning at the beginning of that film.
But the concept they were trying to sell during that point where she's chittering and trying to do that echolocation, that's a brilliant move.
Oh, they had,
but like showing it as flashing lights is dumb.
Yeah, great ideas within the body of the film. They just didn't know how to utilize them in a way that supported the story more than anything else.
Or the budget.
Yeah, like Countess Bathory being this vampire that's changed her name to Jerry Dandridge. Great idea. Really was. Setting it in Romania. Okay. Student trip. And she's in the apartment across from them. And they actually did hunt for a location so they could shoot that practically. Again, so they could just do it cheaper. So they just went from shoot across from each set.
Yeah. And I mean, largely the cast was from Europe there as well, which certainly saved them some money with traveling them over and probably cost less too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I imagine local talent unknown to America would come a lot cheaper, for sure. I'm sure Romania doesn't have, like, a huge talent pool of locally produced stuff anyway, so it was a good opportunity for people to get seen in what probably would have been a big Hollywood production at the time, but it's not. It's a pretty cheap one, actually. Although, I don't know what it costs, because it was meant for direct-to-video, so they don't have to release their numbers.
Yeah, it looks pretty good considering you know that it's a low-budget film. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, you can still tell that it didn't have anywhere near the budget the 2011 remake.
No, I think when it comes to the use of effects for probably what the budget was, they make very good use of their cash in that regard.
Yeah.
It was in the script. I mean, you have one of your most interesting and intriguing characters is Peter Vincent, who's barely in the movie.
I was about to mention that because, he and they made him kind of fun. I think they did a great job of sort of turning that character on its ear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the original film, he's a TV show presenter, very Elvira-ish, and that was the classic Roddy McDowall version. And then when David Tennant did it, he was more of a Chris Angel type. And in this one, it plays off of those reality ghost hunter shows. So they're hunting a location, and it was like a monster hunter show. And he was that kind of TV host, and all of those, like, okay, that they make sense. And he was actually fairly interesting once he got into him, because he was a very flawed character, again, like the original film where he's this kind of born coward. In this one, okay, yeah, there's still shades of that, but he is a rough around the edges, treats his crew like shit, hangs out in a strip joint. Like, I think he lives there.
Yeah. It seemed like it, especially at the end there, right?
Yeah. Like, this is his safety place. You know, he's got
a
room.
There's no hint of a hotel for him to go to.
No, and he rapidly trained the strippers to defend him. They had crucifixes and stakes and while being scantily clad.
Let's touch base on that. There's a lot of that in this movie.
Very much an exploitation movie.
It is. I mean, you have the lingering view of them draining the French girl and then the strip club and Ed's.
Oh, it wasn't lingering for me. Well, I don't. There are two versions of this movie, an unedited one and an edited one. So I don't know about you, but when they were draining her, I'm like, oh boy, she is shaved down there.
Yes. You know? I got lingering.
Okay, so we all saw the same cut.
And that's what I mean by lingering. I mean, they give you a very good look at her entirely naked body.
Oh, yeah. There's actually quite a bit of nudity. And even though Jamie Murray did quite a bit in Dexter, they do kind of keep it fairly light with her nudity. She covers up quite a bit in this.
Yeah.
And probably because they didn't pay her enough for it.
Probably. But I think it worked to the benefit of the character.
I think so too.
It made her feel sexier because you're not getting all the goodies, as it were, sort of shown to you. It's left to your imagination. And that's kind of the way the character is supposed to be, is to sort of leave it to your imagination.
I'd forgotten that they had like a full frontal in the 88 too, that when it happened, I'm like, oh, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah. I'd forgotten about that as well. But an 88 was when we were starting to see more of that exploitation through the use of nudity.
Yeah. The strip joints in both movies.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, maybe the strippers were just kind of relieved. They were like, oh, this is just much easier work. I'd rather do this. Oh, you know what? And a post-credit scene for this that would have been great would have been like a Romanian version of the Peter Vincent show. But it's like, okay, so we quit stripping at a strip club and now we're hunting vampires.
Yeah.
I would have watched it.
Stripper ghost hunters. Yeah,
women following their dreams. They're like, I don't have to take my clothes off for this to fight vampires. Like, it's awesome.
Well, I think there probably is a movie like that already. I know we've seen them with strippers versus zombies. So
yeah, I'm sure there's, but not exploitative. One. It would be Well, speaking about the nudity and the seduction of it all, it made me think that is kind of interesting, and I don't think they really explored this, is like the effortlessness of kind of both of the female leads in this movie. Like, I couldn't quite understand, like, in the first one, she barely speaks, yet still seduces him. Mm-hmm. In the second one, kind of the same thing. Like, and I kind of expected at some point they would make note of it, where it's kind of like these women, like, I've been through the centuries, I know what works.
Yeah.
Well, there's a hypnotic quality to the seduction.
Yeah.
Well, and there's something that happened in the 2013 version that kind of threw me off, because you kind of got the feeling that she was seducing him and she actually was very interested in him as a possible companion, right? As somebody that she wanted to turn. And then all of a sudden it just changes when she finds out that Alex is the one.
Yeah, that comes out of nowhere. Yeah, initially I think it's just, I got the feeling she was just playing with her food because, oh, here's this student that's got a crush on her. But she clearly has no problem enticing food to her, because we see her munching on other students along the way. So there is something about just messing with Charlie's head. I think she's enjoying the game of it more than anything else. I don't know if she needed a companion or whatever. I did kind of miss that she didn't have her own little group, her own little brood. Mm-hmm. And her turning evil Ed happens really late, and not much use is made of it.
Yeah, and it's almost like an aside. It's like, well, let's see how evil you really are, which was a great line.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Although I did like what Peter Vincent had, this big cross tattoo on his chest. And he's like, kiss the cross, bitch. Kiss the cross. I thought that was pretty funny.
And evil Ed is like, that's so gross. And I'm like, you're right. Oh, there's one other thing too. When Charlie comes to go save Alex, and like he and evil Ed have that fight, and I couldn't help but think the entire time, I'm like, okay, I'm sorry, but having a fight where there's a lot of scaffolding and you're breaking wood all around you, bad move for a vampire. There's wood everywhere for him now.
Yeah. And you almost felt like that was going to be the same moment that there was in the 1988
sequel, yes,
where she uses the broken chair to kill the psychiatrist.
Oh no, the rail, the rail tie.
Yeah,
yeah. Sorry, there was an item of opportunity that was missed there in this 2013 version. But I guess they needed to set up that one line.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing too is if she's alone and she's been, they sort of allude to it in the story where she's been alone for centuries. Her husband let her go to go find a way to kind of like live her life. Like, why not dig into that? Like, that's why she doesn't have an entourage. She's just alone and she's a loner because there's nobody around who could possibly understand. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, to be a vampire, like they've dug into this with other movies, being a vampire does seem quite lonely.
I mean, that's the whole point of Dracula. Is how lonely he is.
Yeah, and you know, it's not like she's looking for a cure. She's just looking for a way to interact during the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's looking for more freedom.
Yeah, that's what this ritual is all about, finding this virgin born on this specific day. It's convoluted, and she has to kill her true love for to work. I mean, it's pretty...
Can you explain that to me?
No, I
can't. I didn't get it.
And when it looks like... It looks like Charlie may have killed himself and staked himself. And how does that...
Alex seems to die.
Yeah.
It was so awkward.
Yeah, it really was. Her character was Amy, by the way.
Amy, sorry.
Yeah, and it was weird. Like, what's going on? And then he resurrects and she's feeling better. I'm like, okay, I see how this is tied, but why? Why does this work this way?
I wound it three times to try and... get the answer, because they're talking in that pool of blood, her and Amy.
Yeah.
And I thought the answer was there, and I watched it twice and I got nothing.
Can we talk about the pool of blood? Good Lord.
Yes,
how do you have a pool of blood in an urban center without anybody noticing, like, first off, the sheer number of people who had to die to fill that pool of blood?
Yeah.
Well, there were lots of hidden caverns in Romania when they...
And keeping it from coagulating.
Yeah.
That was going to be my next thing there. Is it a heated pool?
Well, I mean, that blood in that pool looked very different from what was in her tub, which looked a little more legit. Like, I think that pool was water, very much watered down blood. Had both.
Yeah.
I just assumed it was like blood tinted water rather than just blood. But
yeah,
they probably didn't want to make it that much tub blood.
Yeah,
well, it'd been hard for them to move.
It just seemed another one of those things in the movie that seemed a little overdone.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's the point of horror films, right? Is go big and hope that it lands, right?
Yeah. All right, let's run the trailer for Fright Night 2 from 2013, dubbed New Blood, and we'll be right back.
Oh my God.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jerry Dandridge, and I'm a visiting professor.
Ed, check this out.
It's about the missing person. I know it's gonna sound crazy. It was a vampire.
What if I told you we got a real-life vampire problem?
Hey, Professor. Fancy meeting you here.
I'm so glad you could come.
Welcome to Fright Night for Real.
Fright Night 2, New Blood from 2013 was written by Matt Venn. He doesn't have a lot under his belt, but he did the not-so-good Bag of Bones.
I was waiting for you to say something about that.
Fucking hate that movie. Miniseries, I should say. The Exorcism of Molly Hartley, which isn't bad, and the actually fairly decent Masters of Horror episode, Pelts, was from season 2. It was episode 6 of season 2, so that one wasn't bad. But it also had a lot of skin.
Skin-obsessed dude.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's just what he's into, putting his fetishes on film. Directed by Eduardo Rodriguez, who has directed an upcoming horror movie called You're Not Alone. Could be available by the time you hear this. I'm not sure. 2020's really messed up the release schedule of things, so maybe you'll find it. maybe you won't. This stars Will Payne as Charlie Brewster, who was in Mr. Selfridge and the TV show Humans. Jamie Murray was Jeri Dandridge, most famous for her television work on Dexter, Warehouse 13, and most recently a voice of another vampire on the Castlevania Netflix series. Sean Power was Peter Vincent, who primarily is a voice for a lot of your favorite video games. So it was kind of cool to see this voice actor come out and like, hey, you're not a bad actor. He was actually one of the more pleasant aspects of this film, but unfortunately barely got any screen time.
Which is too bad because he does kind of look like Roddy McDowall. There's similarities there. I mean, he's not a clone, obviously, but they definitely got the stature and sort of the
little,
face shape.
A little more gruffer version of. And I quite liked when he was on film. You know, he had his little intro sequence with his little pseudo show, which you see him in. And then they try to recruit him and pay him to come. And at first sight of Fangs, he is off the subway. Then his little freak out with Charlie at the strip joint where he's brandishing this weapon that killed Dracula that he stole from a props department. and then his final sequences where he actually stabs Jeri Dandridge at the end. So that was it. There wasn't a whole lot, and all of his sequences are pretty short. Sasha Parkinson was Amy Peterson, and she's a UK most famous for doing a lot of UK television. You've seen her on like things like Coronation Street. Speaking of other UK actors, Chris Waller, who played Evil Ed, had a nice long stint on EastEnders, so he's a British actor. Yeah. So actually, I thought covered up his accent fairly well because I had no idea he was from England.
No, I thought he was an obnoxious American.
Yeah,
did I say that out loud?
Well, then he did his part right because
he captured it.
And I'm not saying all Americans are obnoxious. I'm just saying that he was sort of that stereotype that everybody kind of expects.
Yeah. So those are your big stars within the movie. And then there's a lot of local talents whose names I can't pronounce and barely had any screen time anyway.
One or two at best.
Yeah, they really kept this cast small and they did this budget small. I imagine even the set pieces all were things that existed already in Romania.
Oh, I'm sure of it, yes. I'm sure if you if you watch more stuff that was produced there, you'd see these go, oh yeah, I remember seeing that and that. On that set you saw on that thing one time.
Well, there's some stuff like you can really, really notice that it's sort of they just kind of dressed a room, like at the point where she chases them through like the catacombs underneath the city, and then they come up outside of it, and suddenly they're in like this place with all this holy stuff around them. They didn't show enough of that room to tell you that it's just a room they put stuff in.
Yeah, those catacombs, I think they were trying to go for something similar. And I do believe that they actually exist in Romania, but I think they were trying to get a vibe that was similar to the catacombs that are under Paris as an underground tomb. And the fact that it opened up into a church, like, again, good idea. You got a pissed off vampire chasing you through these tunnels and you take refuge in a church. You don't know you're in a church, but it wound up being a cool way for them to survive a few minutes more.
Yeah. It sort of looks like a church, but you don't see anything except that tiny portion of the room. You just assume it's a church.
Yeah. And I'm sure they just took a corner of the room and dressed it. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
But then you get to like, again, the pool of blood area with windows. Church windows.
Yeah, the stained glass.
How useful is that?
I'm guessing it wasn't a church. She does have some resistance to it when she toys with him at Amy's room and he thrusts the Bible at her and she doesn't recoil at all, grabs it, and it actually does burn a cross in her hand. So she's got some tolerance. I mean, been around 1,000+ years. Yeah, you probably learn to resist a Bible or a cross or two.
Yeah, and I mean, the stained glass window was clearly a reference to the house in the original Fright Night, because Jeri Dandridge had that big stained glass window that they broke out in order to kill him.
Oh, sure. You know, she had her coffin in a basement and an elevator that went down there. They used the reflective light to burn her up. There's all sorts of things that you can reference back to that original film where they just kind of rejiggered the scene a little bit to suit their needs, but it was essentially the same stuff. They didn't pull a ton of stuff from the 80s one, but they did crib stuff here and there, as I think in her characterization for sure, and the fact that she could resist a cross or a Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because Regine did that too.
Yeah, she did. And yeah, and of course the whole seductiveness of the character, like you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, very much that. I think the performance was very much reflected in there. No crazy performance art or whatever, but it's lots of lingering, smoky seduction going on.
Yeah, I don't think the performance art would have played quite as well on a 2013 version. I think that's why they made her professor instead.
No, they had that was something I kind of enjoyed with some of the experimental aspects of the 88, trying some of that kind of stuff. I mean, doesn't really work these days, but I kind of appreciated that they didn't try to fall into even older tropes where they could have just like, okay, well, here's this TV host. How do you replace him and not fall into the same trappings of like Elvira and whatnot that have come from hosts before and do something unique? And that certainly was.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And it really did give that sequel an interesting visual. Again, it doesn't always work, but I think that aspect of it did.
And using some of her powers as well to make that happen. But also shows in that version of the movie, they can be photographed because she's on television. In the new version, nope, can't do it.
No, that CCTV footage from the gas station, nothing's there.
Yeah, and that's everybody's testing each other. Like, that's how Peter checks on Charlie, is by using his iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, there was something with a great picture that looks terrible.
Yes. I wanted to mention a missed joke opportunity in the 88 sequel, because there's this really sort of inconsequential scene where Merrick Buttrick's character comes in to borrow a tie, and there's that whole thing about don't take the silk one, take the knit one. And then when Charlie's sort of inspecting him to see if he was bitten, he could have maybe noticed that he'd taken the silk tie and then he'd gotten blood on it somehow.
That was kind of missed.
Yeah.
What I thought was the missed joke opportunity you were referring to was like every single time that John Grease leaves Alex, I can't remember, the Brian Thompson character comes by, he's like, you were supposed to bite her. I know. Yeah. Like, and it just keeps going. But then
he was just
happens.
Having fun thinking he was dating.
Well, it was
feeling human for a minute.
Yeah, well, they established that he's a lech and a peeping Tom fairly early on. There's that great scene where he's peeping and they close the window on his hands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very 80s. I mean, it's not something that you would typically see in a movie now where they have a character who's, well, that creepy. But it was funny at the time, and it was kind of fun to sort of see them go to that particular trope and have consequences for it.
Now, here's something, Trish, you probably noticed this. When Peter and Alex are scaling the building, what is the one tip for doing this that maybe people should take home with them?
When they're scaling the building.
Sensible shoes.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Because I was thinking, as soon as you said that, I'm like, cowboy boots. And I'm like, no, because here's the point. Cowboy boots, just for you, those of you who don't know.
No,
the
no point better of than them dress is, shoes.
Well, their dress shoes are slightly better because of a very significant portion. The reason that they're kind of smooth at that front part is in case something goes wrong and you need to slip out of stirrups rather than being dragged by a horse.
Oh.
That's also why the heel's there. It's the ease of getting your boots in and out of the stirrups. You don't want a grip on there.
Right.
It sucks. It's not good. It's uncomfortable. So what she's climbing with is something that's designed to slip off.
Yeah, I kept thinking, I'm like, oh no, it's going to end before it starts.
I know.
This is going to be
the style
worst,
was great, but
this is going to be the worst rescue in history.
Right?
It kind of was.
Yeah, it didn't go very well, but nobody fell off a building.
Almost.
That's true.
Yeah, but it wasn't her. It was Peter Vincent. Yeah, no, yeah. Sensible shoes. Definitely. You are correct. It's so funny when you mention that. I thought of that, but I'm like, is that what he means? But it is true. And there's a lot of scaling of buildings. In the remake, Charlie just, he can't get into the building, so he decides to climb up to the top of it. Who does that?
Yeah, and not your bit. Like, he was just going to go back to his room, but they couldn't get back in, so he goes to hers?
Yeah. Oh, and fun fact, if you're ever in a house and discover a secret room, don't go in there to hide. because that's where people are going to go.
It's not a secret to the person who lives there.
Exactly.
And typically there's going to be no way out of a secret room.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, you just saw her scale down a building with a body and you want to hang around.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And she was aware you were watching her from across the street when she's making out with this other chick.
Yeah.
Yeah, sexy movie. So I'm pretty sure she's going to be aware of you hiding in her coffin.
Yeah.
And she was.
And she was.
Yeah, Charlie is like the worst. You know, there should have been a joke where it's like, you know, remember when we played hide and seek? I could find you all the time. You're the worst hider, Charlie.
Yeah, for a guy who's been stalking people for like four movies, he sure sucks at it.
Yeah, that should be part three. He's learned to hide.
Well, but I think that that speaks to the character, is because he's a normal person who's gotten thrown into an unnatural position where he's come across something supernatural. Of course, he has no understanding of how to investigate something like this because he's got no frame of reference. I mean, he's clumsier than maybe he should be, but I would expect him to be somewhat clumsy or inexperienced in it, I would hope.
Yeah, I can kind of get that, because in the remake, he's not really established as like a movie buff. And I guess what my quibbles are like what the original Charlie would have known, I think. I think you're right in this, that he would be clumsy, because the original Charlie would know about secret rooms and hiding properly.
Before I forget, let's talk about Charlie and Amy. How pathetic is he?
Well, yeah.
I mean, it was cringe. It was serious cringe watching him give her the flowers and the candy. I bought this for you. And I mean, that is such a teenager thing to do. It's like, I can buy your attention back, but it just was really, really cringy.
Yeah, they tried to allude that he cheated on her, which just sounds like he was just caught with somebody else. A misunderstood way rather than an actual cheating way, because you don't want your hero to look like an ass right before anything happens. It's like, oh, he's a cheating dick. Oh, well, maybe we should kill Charlie.
Hmm. Well, and that's sort of that whole thing, I think, where I don't think it's sort of undiscovered in a lot of these movies, which sort of made me sad. Like, they say Amy has to kill like the one thing that she loves the most, and that's Charlie. So I keep thinking, like, in a lot of these movies, it's like going, oh, great, because I'm not in a relationship, I'm not sacrificial enough. I feel kind of insulted. Well, there's other types of love where you can have a friend that you love so much you would sacrifice them. Mm-hmm. Well, why not do that?
Well, and the other thing, too, is they're teenagers, right? This is not your one true love.
Yeah.
Right? Really, it's not. It's very rare that your true love, you meet them in high school. It's
yeah.
Yeah, it's a really terrible trope that needs to go away.
Well, even Charlie in university in the original sequel, I mean, yeah, it's a university relationship. But even those maybe not are going to work out. They're more likely to, but it doesn't mean it's going to.
Exactly. I just think the whole one true love thing needs to go away.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Like a friendship love. There's people that are my friends that I would do anything for. So yeah, that makes sense. There need to be more friend love movies.
Yeah. I mean, my one true love could be my iPad for all you know. Right? I spend more time with that than I do with anything else. Right? I mean, just as an example, I mean.
One true love could be pizza. How do you do with it?
It's just a really terrible, terrible conceit that they continue to use in movies.
Well, yeah. I would have loved it if she did murder Charlie and nothing happened.
Oh, nice.
You know, I was almost expecting it to not have the happy ending, and I was hoping for it.
Yeah.
The way they set it up so beautifully to not have the happy ending.
I might have liked it more if they would have just subverted expectations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I was excited when I saw that sort of happen. I'm like, oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, because they almost tease it, too. She's like, well, what makes you think he's my true love?
Yeah. See, and when he kills himself, what would have been great is she would have said, see, what did I tell you?
Yeah. I mean, maybe it was something in the blood, because like Jerry said, she could taste the fact that she was a virgin born on this day. It's like tasting wine, I guess. You just know the vintage. But maybe maybe you can taste the true love in there too. I don't know.
No, it was it was just, I mean, I keep using the word clumsy, but it was.
Yes, some pretty awkward things to fill in a plot hole.
Yeah.
Well, with the new, you've introduced a new trope that I desperately want to see as a vintage. No, it's delicious. It's about mid-90s grunge. There's a bit of a pot finish. I really love it.
Yeah, there's a nice smoky whiskey undertone.
Yes. This one I don't like as much. There's a bit of a heroin-y aftertaste.
Oh my!
With this a skunky, with a skunky marijuana.
This is a mid '80s one. There's a little bit of a cocaine buzz that comes along with it.
Yeah, no, I do like that. I like that. That would be funny, actually. Yeah.
It tastes like big hair and bad decisions.
Nice.
Oh, okay. I know what my next shirt's going to be. I don't know how I'm going to make it, but it tastes like big hair and bad decisions. I've got to figure out how to do that.
Yeah, I have the most 80s pink and like bright colors ever.
But I'm going to figure that one out.
Look forward to hit our TeePublic storefront eventually.
Oh, it's going to. There's no question. It's just what it's going to look like. And I'm writing it down so I don't forget.
Oh, that's so wonderful. I'm so, yay. I might take a crack at it too. I have a visual in my head right now.
Okay, you go for it.
Best one gets the shirt.
Nice. But yeah, like, I mean, the remake, like you say, is so rushed and so clumsy, and there were great ideas, just so misused.
And it's a shame. IMDb doesn't treat it well either. Actually, the original Fright Night Part 2 from 1988 didn't have the greatest reviews either. 5.9 out of 10 on IMDb versus the 4.3 of Fright Night 2 from 2013. So neither one of them well reviewed in that regard. Rotten Tomatoes wasn't any kinder. The original had a 30% critic score with a 42% audience score. There weren't even enough critic reviews for the 2013 to rate, and the audience score was a meager 17%.
Whoa.
Which I think is far harsher than the movie deserves. It's great, but there's some neat ideas in here, and the makeup and stuff, the effects for its meager budget, were quite well done.
And I'd say that the two lead performances, well, actually all three, were pretty solid. I don't think anything about this movie was the fault of the performers.
No, I mean, I love Jamie Murray. I mean, I would be a very happy man if she was in everything I watched.
Oh, I want to see her, like, lead something again, because it's just, she just commands the camera.
Yeah, she's very scene stealer. She was in another vampire show now that I'm thinking about it, the CW one. Oh, what was that?
The Originals.
The Originals, that was it. Yeah, she was in The Originals as well. Yeah. So she's no stranger to doing vampires.
No, and I mean, she doesn't need to, but she's very good at it.
Yeah.
But she's very good at everything I've seen her in. I mean, she was the highlight of the season of Dexter she was in.
Yeah, I think that was probably arguably one of the best seasons Dexter had was her season. And I guess she was on Once Upon a Time. I kind of gave up on that show before she showed up. But usually when she comes in for a guest spot, it's for an entire season because she's such a great femme fatale bad guy.
Yeah, and not just that, she just has this otherworldly quality about her where, something mystical or fantastical is perfect for her.
Yeah, well, she played H.G. Wells on Warehouse 13.
Nice.
Which, you know, you'll have to go watch it to figure that one out, but I liked that. I thought that was pretty great. It was a very different role for her from most of the things I'd seen her in. So
awesome.
For a UK actor, I wouldn't mind her being like the next female doctor if they go down that road again.
Oh, yeah.
Well, she's got quite good in that role, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because she can deliver humor. She's got that playfulness about her.
Actually, she'd be better as a female villain. They've already done the female master, but they have never resurrected the Ronnie from the original series of Doctor Who. And man, she'd be pretty badass in that role.
Oh, yes, casting directors who are listening to our podcast, take note. We have ideas. She can do this.
Yes. Jamie Murray will have a reason to go back home. I think she lives in Hollywood these days, but
yeah.
Well, it's because the work is, right?
Yeah. Well, It's not like there isn't work in the UK.
But, no, but the work that she, the stuff that she seems to be getting work in seems to be.
Yeah, she seems to have gone that summer glow route of let's go in a lot of genre stuff because the geeky watchers really dig me and it works.
Yeah.
She's been flitting around from genre show to genre show, and I don't know if she's got the reputation for it, but she keeps getting cast in that stuff, and I think maybe she should have that reputation because it's carved a nice little niche market for herself.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Well, any last thoughts about Fright Night? It was fun to revisit this. I guess we don't have any more Fright Nights to do now, but it was fun to just to look at a sequel to something we've done. This may never happen again on our show.
No,
it's pretty unlikely. There's not a lot of them.
No.
You know, the original 88 sequel, I liked it more than I remember liking it the first time. There's a lot there that I really just enjoyed.
I quite enjoyed watching the 88. It still has a good sense of humor. And like Sam said, it's borrowed heavily from some of the cool factor of Lost Boys. And is somewhat effective with it. Because I really liked just the Regine brood. Regine herself wasn't very interesting.
Yeah.
But her little group of vampires was fantastic.
Yeah, and that's they were the highlight of the movie for me, to be honest. And one thing about this movie too is they had that really fabulous movie poster.
Oh, yes, I do remember the movie poster. I remember you used to have that hanging on your wall at home.
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
I might even still have it kicking around somewhere, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I actually thought the posters for both were pretty good, but the original poster just was the simple like lipstick lips with the fangs, and it's on white, and it's really affecting. It's a really great-looking poster, and there's just a sexiness to the remake poster of Jamie Murray, half profile on the poster on black, and little blood dripping down her face. Looks pretty cool.
Yeah, well, both the original movie posters are just really good. If you can get them and put them on your wall, I recommend it highly.
Yeah, there's this sexy scary to it. I don't know how else to describe that, but eerie sexiness.
Yeah. Well, I think my only final thoughts is now that when you're talking about three, I just have remake ideas in my head where I just kind of see when you talk about the Lost Boys, I kind of envision William Ragsdale is the father of the Frog Brothers, and that's sort of how that comes about.
Well, that's interesting. Well, like, where would you go bringing back the original cast of the original film?
I
mean, I guess you don't want to bring like the vampires back per se, because
defeats
the purpose. Yeah, it defeats the purpose. I mean, you can flashback maybe or have those actors in different roles because they're being very visibly older and not recognizable as their younger selves, but I wouldn't want to resurrect a vampire.
I would almost put Charlie's character as like a professor type where he talks about the supernatural and the history and lore of it, without sort of outing himself as somebody who's actually experienced it.
That's not a bad idea.
I had him as a weed farmer living as a recluse in New Mexico.
That's funnier.
One kind of embraces...
A weed/garlic farmer.
Yeah, one kind of embraces what he does, had gone through in a way that's being able to inform others, and others just completely gone in hiding away from humanity altogether.
Yeah, we have two different takes on it, Sam, but I love both of them. Yours I think yours is a little bit better, though.
Yeah,
I think it would feed a story better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that yours is more of like a where are they now type of situation.
Yeah,
I don't know what Tom Holland's got planned because you don't have your Peter Vincent anymore either.
No,
and that's probably the most interesting character of the films.
And see, I would put him in like in my three where he died when another vampire came in after the second movie. He died fighting another vampire. Because I liked him going down as a hero.
Yeah, no, I could sort of see that sort of being a backstory for the Charlie character where when he loses Peter, that's when he moves into a life of being a professor.
Well,
he can't do the active life without his partner in crime.
They could catch back up with him and put him back in the loony bin, because that was a big plot point within the 88 was he tries to attack Regine on the show in front of a live audience. So he is committed because he's talking about she's a vampire and all this stuff. And that's something very public that's not going to go away. So he would have been probably retired in shame.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, I think that goes to the lesson that would be learned from this sequel anyhow, is that, you know what, you can experience it, but don't talk about it because nobody's going to believe you. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. Charlie finds a way to talk about it in a way that allows him to share his knowledge without people going, geez, this guy's nuts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Or he could also be a writer of a very successful vampire series of novels. And the reason they are is because they're so believable.
Oh, here you go. You find the sire of Regine and Jerry, and that would be your first season. Person that turned them in the first place. So you get into
that. Who would that be?
I don't know.
But do you think it would be a famous one?
Could be. I actually really like the idea of Jerry Dandridge being Countess Bathory. There hasn't been a lot of great Blood Queen in movies, so that wasn't a bad idea, but I don't know if you want to do it again because it might scare people away from how crappy this one was.
True. But there, yeah, like you say, there hasn't been a lot of really good stuff about Countess Bathory. And I mean, there, I think it's sort of alluded to in the Carmilla, that sort of, that tale of Carmilla. Because I like the idea too of like Bathory, the reason Carmilla sort of works is because there's that sort of sexual tension between her and the people that she's eating. Mm-hmm. And to have it like as being a lesbian, probably in like the late, I don't know when Bathory is around 16th, 17th century, not optimal. People didn't like that type of thing, but to have her be around now where she could be openly gay, that would be kind of interesting to dig into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think there's lots of legendary vampires you could pull from, so I don't know. Maybe any of those will be good. Any other vampire movies our audience would like us to maybe remake, or if there's already a remake, compare, let us know at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion of the Remake on Instagram and Facebook, and invasionoftheremake@gmail.com. If you want to email us your suggestions, your questions, your comments, and even your fan challenges. We're going to try to get to those again soon. We don't have much time before we get into our all the horror crossovers for October, and we'll all have our 31 Days of Horror specials in November as well. So we're going to have about 6 weeks of horror content coming up as we participate in all the horror, with some guests crossing over into our show as well as us guesting on some other ones. And you can track all that by following at All the Horror 18 on Twitter and their Facebook page. Is that just All the Horror, Sam?
It is just All the Horror, yeah.
Yeah, so follow All the Horror. And they have a webpage as well, correct?
Yeah, they do. It's allthehorror18.wixsite.com/event.
There you go. And yeah, you can follow all the goings-on all October as a new podcast with the All the Horror theme will land every single day of the month of October, so to celebrate everything scary in October.
Yeah, and don't forget that they have t-shirts, and if you buy one of their t-shirts, all the profits or proceeds go to the Scares That Care charity. So this is a completely non-profit setup.
Yeah, and I saw a bunch of new designs this year.
There's 4 new designs this year. Yeah, we're trying something different this year. I think that they have a new look that I'm actually really pleased with.
Yeah, there's some pretty creepy ones in there this year. So if you like to wear the horror on your chest, go for it. We can also get other merchandise as well, masks, mugs, pillowcases, and prints, and all sorts of cool stuff over at TeePublic. And you can do that with our store as well. We just launched the Angry Fish line. So go check out Angry Fish as well as I Survived 31 Days of Horror, I'm That Person You Saw in That Thing That One Time, mm-hmm. and other Invasion goodness as well. We got more stuff coming up, and Sam just teased a new one today.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's going to happen. Either Trish will do it or I will, but that shirt is going to happen. I just love that line.
Yes.
That's 2 weeks in a row Trish's inspired tease. So.
Yay!
That's
right. Thanks.
Keep being the idea treasure chest.
I'm the muse of t-shirts.
Yes. And you can be our muse as well by telling people about the show. Tell them where to find us and how cool we are. Ton of different places, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, and all your favorite podcast providers. So just have them search us out, add us to their subscription list, and away you go. 5 years plus of amazing content for you to engorge on and binge on. Like a greedy little vampire.
Yes.
We are your life's blood.
We are eternal.
Like remakes. Just keep happening.
Just keep happening, indeed. Podcast Movement had posted on Twitter, hey, what would be the headline for your show if it was a news item in a newspaper? I'm like, Hollywood remakes trap podcast hosts in self-imposed purgatory. That would be us.
That would be us.
Yes, I saw that and it made me laugh. And cry a little bit too.
They won't stop. Why won't they stop?
They just keep coming. Why? Why? I thought they were new ideas. Why?
Yes, we've been broken in 5 years.
Well, I think isolation might have something to do with part of it.
Quite possibly. But
we wouldn't have been broken had we been stuck in a bunker together. I think it would have been fine.
Oh, maybe. Maybe. We're okay, though. We're going to try to squeeze out a fan challenge for you next week before we get into the all the horror episodes for October. And then we will try to get one, maybe two more out before the end of the year. And then we'll probably look at doing more in the following year. We'll definitely do some more. So if you have a request, go ahead, put it in now. I do keep a list, and we will get to yours eventually if we think it's a good idea. Now, we do have a little bit of rules for fan challenges as well. Try to be unique. Explain why you think it should be remade. Doesn't have to be long. And tell us where to find it as well so we can source it out if we think it's a good idea. But don't go for anything too modern. I'm not even going to look at it if it's in the year 2000 plus. So I know that's 20 years ago now, but in my mind, not worthy.
There's the odd exception, but for the most part, yeah, you're right. Yes.
To be fair, considering how we are, we feel very young inside. So 2000 just happened.
Yeah.
For us.
Yes, it does feel that way for us. It doesn't feel that long ago to me.
Exactly.
And I mean, come on, look at our library and look at the things we like to remake. So keep it interesting, keep it weird. The weirder, the more fun we have. So, and we hope you have more fun too. And of course, we'll shout you out if we do your episode.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know what? There's so much challenges and the weird ones. There's been such treasures that have been introduced to us that we wouldn't have known about.
Yeah, that's why we like doing these, is because we get exposed to things that aren't going to be on our list normally.
Yeah, and we've been exposed to some stuff where it's like, oh my, not good, but fun. Yeah.
But I wouldn't even say that. Occasionally we've had some like, oh wow.
Oh no, absolutely. I'm not saying that they're all bad. I mean, Portrait of Jenny is still one of the best recommendations ever. I thoroughly enjoyed that movie.
But there's also been downs.
And then Alligator People. It's a fun watch, but I would not say it's a good movie.
Yeah, we still got to
finish Hard Rock Zombies, which was just terrifying.
Yeah, and we still got to finish Cade's trilogy. He's patiently waiting. He had made a suggestion and then changed his mind to keep it in the 50s. So, and then his first suggestion for the 70s is pretty good too. So probably won't happen this year. We'll probably get to finish the Cade trilogy next year. But we haven't forgot about our good friend Cade, because he's throwing some good stuff at us. That's why we keep pulling his from his lists, because they're pretty fun for us.
Very much so. I bow down to like the arc of a knowledge that this guy has of stuff that I'd never even heard of.
Yeah, for sure. He got exposed to a lot of cool stuff as a kid that probably passed me by. But I'm
totally stuck with him.
Yeah, yeah, I'm hoping to get to some older horror movies for my 31 Days of Horror watches. So look out for that. And we'll drop our 31 Days of Horror episodes in early November, because we've got to get through October. And 31 Days of Horror, we watch 31 movies. That's a horror movie every single day. But the way we watch it is we got to watch a horror movie we've never seen before, and then we'll tell you about it in those specials.
And to everybody who always asks, is it that hard? No, actually. There's new horror movies coming out all the time. So, I mean, if we want to do an older one, sometimes it gets harder because you can't, like, sort of, you go to that well only so many times. But yeah, no, there's always a lot out there.
There's over 100 years worth of horror films. And there was it 2018? They had 1,800 and something horror films.
Mm.
Horror films.
Yeah, we're not going to run out of material to watch for 31 Days of Horror with that kind of output. So don't you worry. We have plenty to talk about, and it's always fun to just have a sit down and say, hey, this is what I watched, and find unintentional patterns in what we watched. And
That always happens.
Always happens where you just, like, I had a year where I was just like, there was a lot of cults in my movies. I don't know why. Yeah. It worked out that way. I didn't intend it. It just kind of happened. It's like, oh, I want to watch this movie. It sounded pretty cool, not knowing much about it. And then, oh, look, another cult.
Yeah.
It happens, and that's kind of the fun of it, too, that the weird patterns will happen along the way as well. And what it might do to you psychologically over one month.
Yes. If you want to challenge yourself and play by our rules, by all means. It's pretty interesting. You'll find out things about yourself you may not know.
Yes, and if you have done follow along with us, send us your lists, and if you get it to us in time, we will try to read a grip of them on the show. What were you going to say, Sam?
I was just going to say, I mean, talking about being desensitized, I remember when we talked about the Martyrs episode, how it affected me a lot more this rewatch, because I wasn't desensitized because of all the horror I'd watched leading up to it. Because, I just really found it a lot more affecting than my first watch. The first watch, I'm like, what's Jay talking about? This isn't that bad. But then on the rewatch, I was definitely more affected.
Yeah, because you were watching a lot of horror movies at that point in time, the first go around. Yeah.
You had the horror vaccination before you watched Martyrs.
Yes.
Okay, well, that was our Fright Night 2 episode. We're going to try to squeeze in a fan challenge for you next week, and then it's all the horror. So join us next week. I think Jeff Omega will be back. But until then, I've been Jason.
I'm always Sam.
And I continue to be Trish.
And we are out of here.
Something of what you're feeling, and it's important for you to experience that. I'll take care of it myself. I think I got it. Here they go.